Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The con man. The notion is about as old as time, and the sucker. There's one born every minute and everywhere, even as the victims of fake investor Bernie Madoff still reel from his elaborate Ponzi scheme from several years ago, considered the largest in U.S. history. Chinese police have arrested 21 people over an online scam that allegedly took in the equivalent of $7.6 billion from about 900,000 investors. We're talking about what makes a con man and what makes a mark these days. Joining us by phone is psychologist and author Maria Konnikova. Her new book is entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You opened the book with and referred repeatedly throughout it to Ferdinand Waldo Demara. The guy was sort of a genius in his own way. What drew you to him?
Well, I think you've captured it. He really was a genius in his own way, and I think he would have been incredibly successful in any career he chose. He just happened to choose that of the imposter. What drew me to him was the fact that he pulled off this audacious scam after audacious scams for decades, and he kept getting caught, and he got caught in very public ways. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He had this huge biography written, The Great Imposter by Robert Crichton. Then there was a movie with Tony Curtis based on that book. And despite all of that publicity, he still managed to keep conning people, including his biographer, by the way, whom he conned right after the book came out.
The way you opened the book with his story and the story that you chose to open it with, I thought for sure the con man was going to be on that raft of dying people or injured people that he didn't rescue them, but he certainly operated on them and saved their lives.
Absolutely. And this con was, I think, his most audacious.
Tell us about that.
So he impersonated a doctor. He stole the credentials of Dr. Sear, who was a surgeon, and he joined the Canadian Royal Navy. This was during the Korean War. And he basically was so incredibly persuasive that not only did they accept his credentials, but they appointed him as the only medical doctor, the only surgeon aboard a ship heading for Korea for enemy waters. And so he was there in charge of hundreds of men, no other doctors in sight. And what ends up happening is obviously we're in the middle of a war. And so there's a boat that they see with Korean soldiers who've been in an ambush and they've been very seriously wounded and they need to be operated on or they're going to die. And instead of running away, as you suspected he might, and as actually I suspected he might, and as we'd think any sane person would, this guy who has no high school education, he doesn't even, he dropped out, never even finished that, operates on them. He cuts people open. He actually performs surgery, and nobody dies. Nobody dies on his operating table. He is very, very smart. He has a medical textbook on board. Also, before leaving, he had conned another doctor into writing a guide, a field guide for the troops. He said, doctor, you're so wonderful. I could learn so much from you. What happens if the troops don't have me, if they're in the middle of a battle and they need an emergency guide? So this doctor is very, very flattered, writes this guide, and that's the other thing that he has to go on. But then he just has the gall and the nerve to operate. And then he gets caught, obviously, not because anyone dies, but because the media is so incredibly impressed that there's a doctor who operated on Korean soldiers, even though he didn't need to. And so dispatches cover Canada, and he is caught by the real doctor who says, hey, wait a minute, I'm not in Korea. And the Navy doesn't press charges. They are so embarrassed. Their reputation has suffered so much that instead of pressing charges, they just ask him to quietly disappear, which he promptly does.
Which goes, is unreal.
Yep, absolutely unreal. And so then he goes back to North America and promptly reenlists in the Navy, this time under another name, and just keeps right on going.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the con man this hour and the victims of the con man. My guest is Maria Konnikova. She's author of a new book. It's entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. And his story also encapsulates another element to this equation, and that is the reluctance to turn people in who are con men.
That's absolutely right. And it's really terrible because we have absolutely no reliable statistics even on how many people get scammed, how much money is lost, what is lost, because it's not just money. I mean, in the case of someone like Damara, there was really no cash that he got out of it.
Right.
So how much is lost? Because people are so embarrassed. And so almost nobody presses charges because they don't admit that they don't want to be seen as victims. I think our culture has a lot to do with that because we tend to really victim blame in this particular situation. We think that if you fell for a con, then you must be stupid, you're gullible, you're greedy, there's something wrong with you. We really glamorize the con artist and we really blame the victim. And that's not the case of a lot of other crimes. So I think people are reluctant with good reason. They don't want others to think that they were stupid.
The con is a big part of elder crime or mm-hmm. crimes against older people, but and we often think of it as somebody who's maybe not that bright or maybe who's older and comes from another kind of trusting generation. But people who are victims of cons, they run the gamut too.
Oh, absolutely. I was really surprised at how many people, both that I interviewed and that I just came across as I researched this, how many of them were remarkably smart, well-educated, skeptical. I mean, there are even, you know, scientists, skeptics, people who are members of skeptical societies who end up falling for these things. And what you end up learning when you look through the research and through all of the attempts to figure out, well, who is a victim, is the answer is everyone. Anyone is a potential victim. And I was really shocked by that. You know, I went into this with an attitude that said, well, you know, I couldn't fall for a con like that. You know, I'm a psychologist. I'm smart. I know better. And I realized that actually, no, for some cons, I'm the ideal victim. And that is something that is really difficult to accept because, once again, we don't want to see ourselves as marks. We want to see ourselves as smarter than that.
How do we define a con man? And by the way, I use con man purposely because, as you pointed out in the book, they usually are, by and far, men.
Yes, which is, I think, that actually goes to, and we can talk about this a little bit more, the fact that a good number of them are psychopaths, and psychopaths, mm-hmm. over 99% of them, are male. So that's where we get that gender imbalance. And I do try to profile some women as well, because mm-hmm. I want to make sure that people realize that women are good at this too. There are just fewer of them. But the definition of con man, so the original term, confidence man, came from this wonderful, and I say wonderful because it's kind of charming and no one really got hurt, scam in the 1800s, where this man would approach people on the streets of Manhattan and say, "Have you the confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow?" And it was just such a bizarre thing, and it really kind of impinged on who you are, what kind of a person are you, what kind of a world do you live in, are you a gentleman, because I'm a gentleman. And so many people ended up giving him their watches and obviously never saw them again. And so this is the term confidence man. And so the key is, we're talking about confidence as trust. I give you my confidence and you take my confidence, but you're going to misuse it. You're taking it for your own ends. And those ends are something that will benefit you. They might be financial, but they might not be. They might be reputation. They might be love, power, a sense of control. Whatever it is, I am willingly giving you my confidence.
And until I read it in your book, I really didn't kind of get this idea of how much we need to be trusting as humans, that that's part of our survival.
Absolutely. I was actually pretty surprised at this initially, too. Once I read the research, it actually makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was counterintuitive. I thought, well, of course, we're going to distrust others because we don't want to be taken advantage of. Actually, no, it ends up that the evolutionarily advantageous route is to trust people. And we see a lot of work that shows that people with higher levels of trust are smarter. They end up doing better financially. They're happier. They're healthier. And societies with higher levels of trust end up being more successful. They have better institutions. They're more economically developed. And once you start thinking about this, you realize, oh, well, to create society, we have to trust each other. You have to trust that people are not going to completely just undermine you, screw you over, and leave you hanging, because otherwise, how in the world would we build institutions? How would we forge relationships? How would we protect each other? There has to be that element of trust that underlies it all. And then you start seeing from people like Daniel Gilbert, who's a psychologist at Harvard University, that trust is actually our default for perceiving the world, period. So we trust everything we see. That's kind of the first step of understanding. And only then, the second step is verification. And that second step not almost never, but sometimes does not happen. And so we end up in our default of trust, and we never really question or verify.
And the confidence men, the con men out there are sort of like a virus that preys on that.
Absolutely.
Or a bad cold, maybe pneumonia, depending on if you're in China right now, right?
Absolutely. That's a very good way of looking at it. And I think that's key. There are a few of them. They aren't a majority, because it's a very successful strategy if there's only a few of you. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone trusts everyone, then of course you can be that person who takes advantage of that trust and actually will be the person who proves the exception, who isn't trustworthy, and who actually will do you wrong in all sorts of ways. And if there were more of them, it would no longer work, because then if everyone is out to get you, first of all, then trusting people stops being advantageous. And secondly, everyone becomes more guarded. And you see that actually happen in societies where people start turning each other in. Like if we look at the historical Soviet Union, mm-hmm. nobody trusted anyone. And I think that there, you're no longer the exception. Basically, everyone thinks of everyone else as a potential criminal.
Another revelation in the book to me was the predisposition that con men have for being the mark.
Yes. So I think, to my mind, that's the best illustration that this can happen to anyone.
Right.
The fact that con artists can be conned. And in fact, there are cons that are targeted specifically at con artists by other con artists. They often like to do this if someone gets a little too big for his britches, then they like to take them down a notch, and they'll often run some sort of a sweetheart scam or something like that. Sweetheart scams are romance scams where someone is not who you think that she or he is. And so there are also elements of just this disbelief that if I'm a con artist, then I could never be con, because I know exactly how this works, that you're then able to take advantage of. One of my favorite stories is this guy, Oscar Hartzell, who pulled off a huge con in the United States and then was in England and ended up falling for a psychic, which you would think nobody would ever
right.
fall for. And he ended up giving her tens of thousands of dollars. We're talking the early part of the 20th century, so this is a lot of money back then. So here he is stringing along hundreds of people for thousands and thousands of dollars, getting them to believe in a fake treasure that doesn't actually exist, and going to seances with this woman who realizes exactly what he's up to, because she is very smart, hires a private investigator, and then ends up learning all this stuff about him and uses the exact same techniques that he's used, but now she cons him and he's none the wiser.
We're talking about the con man and the marks of the con man, the victims. My guest is Maria Konnikova. She's author of a new book. It's entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Lance Armstrong was once the hero of every American cycling buff after he won the Tour de France seven consecutive times from 1999 to 2005. And his fight against cancer became the gold standard for helping others overcome the adversity of the disease. But even after Armstrong was stripped of those victories in 2012, after a protracted doping scandal, he vehemently denied the allegations. That is, until a 2013 interview with Oprah Winfrey.
This story was so perfect for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that as I try to take myself out of the situation and I look at it. You overcome the disease. You win the Tour de France seven times. You have a happy marriage. You have children. I mean, it's just this mythic, perfect story.
Yes.
And it wasn't true.
We're talking about con artists and why we fall for their lies. Still with us is psychologist and author Maria Konnikova. Her new book is entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Tell us about the dark triad that you write about in the book, Maria. And if you can, in terms of the likes of Lance Armstrong.
So the dark triad is something that a lot of con artists have, either one, two, or all of the triad traits. The first one we've mentioned briefly, that's psychopathy, which is this lack of empathy and the inability to experience emotions the way that other people do. So it's much more a cold, calculating experience than it is kind of an emotionally involved one. And what that enables people to do, con artists to do, is to justify taking advantage of others because you don't actually feel any sort of guilt or remorse in doing it. You say, yep, all good. We're all, let's go forward with it. We're totally fine. And something that con artists will say is, you know, you cannot feel any sympathy for your victim. The moment you do, you're dead in the water. And that is what psychopathy enables you to achieve. You have no sympathy for the people you're taking advantage of. The second part of that is narcissism, which isn't just ego. It's a sense of entitlement. I think we see this in Armstrong a lot because this is something that doesn't just provide the justification. It also makes you think that you deserve it more than other people. So if you think about Armstrong's doping, he was also basically saying, you know, I don't care about any of you. I've beaten cancer. I deserve to beat this. So I'm going to dope. I deserve the extra edge because I deserve to win this. I am going to take it no matter what. We can liken this to someone like Ferdinand de Mara, who thought he was smarter than all PhDs. So he just took a PhD. He said, why do I have to work? Because I'm already more intelligent. For Armstrong, the reasoning was, you know, I'm better and I deserve to win, so why do I have to do the work? Basically, let me just take it, which is exactly what he did. And the final part is Machiavellianism, and that's the ability to persuade people to do what you want them to do, but it's much more subtle, so they don't actually think that they're being manipulated. They think that they are actually doing what is in their best interest, and they're doing it because they want to do it. And if you think about it, then I think you realize that Armstrong was incredibly good at this because his teammates, everyone protected him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that they felt pressured by him, at least not that we know of. Mm-hmm. I think it was more of a, you know, he deserves this, so of course we're going to protect him. So I don't know that he's a psychopath, but I think the other two we can definitely see and play in a situation like that.
I want to get to a couple calls, but first I wanted to talk. You've said that you stopped talking to the con artists you were writing about halfway through your research, and that's really interesting because I've interviewed con artists before, and I related to what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was really eye-opening for me to realize that even if I knew that I was talking to a con artist, and even if this was a con artist who really ruined lives and did some terrible things, talk to them long enough and you see their charm. They're not sleazy. They're not someone who you would ever spot as being a con artist. They're charismatic. They're warm. They're persuasive. They actually, I had some of them, you know, they did research on me. They'd say, oh, you know, that piece you wrote a few years ago, I really liked that paragraph where you talk about this. They would quote me back to me, and that's flattering. You know, I would say, oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much. You know, you're a good person. You are so incredibly perceptive. So they're using these tricks on you, mm-hmm. and you find yourself falling for it. And then the reason I stopped was I actually found myself making excuses for them. So I reread something that I wrote where I was really just glamorizing and whitewashing this one guy. And I just thought, oh no, you know, I cannot be doing this. This is really making me a non-objective observer, which is what I need to be in order to make this book actually work. It's scary. It's very frightening. Even when you know you're dealing with a con artist, they can still be so effective.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about The Con Man with Maria Konnikova. She's the author of a new book. It's entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Ray in Columbus, you're an attorney and you've represented a con man before. Welcome.
Oh, many con man, Ann. Many con man.
Okay.
But one sticks out in particular. And this is a gentleman that I represented a few years back in a pretty complex Ponzi scheme that I got to know real well, and it kind of reminded me about the good doctor's comment about being a non-objective just observer, because over 6 months of representing this gentleman, I went to his house to dinner, and I communicated frequently, you know, on a personal level about his family and things like that, and he was really good at what he did as far as being a con man, but what makes the case interesting and why I called is that this gentleman was a war hero. He was a Vietnam vet, and some of his family members, not the client, told me about his war history. So I double-checked, and I was able to get records from the Department of Defense. He was in Special Forces. He was awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, multiple Purple Hearts. And not only with the records came with, you know, a kind of a synopsis of what he did to earn the medals. And the guy was incredibly brave. So what I did was I referred the case for a confidential psychological evaluation, you know, that was confidential between me and the doctor. And I'd use it in court if it was beneficial for my client, but mm-hmm. I didn't use it because what the expert told me is that, you know, my client was a sociopath. And I asked, I said, well, how do you jive that with, you know, him being a war hero and all these, you know, instances of valor and saving lives and this and that? And he told me that, you know, based on his experience and interviewing with my client just, as, you know, characteristic of a sociopath, he just didn't have any fear. The guy was fearless. So he was able to excel on the battlefield and combat environments because of some of the same characteristics that made him a good con man.
Interesting.
And this guy was such a good con man that I felt so comfortable with him that I had an incident where my little chihuahua injured his leg very severely. And the first person I called, you know, was this client who calmly walked me through what to do to put the dog on a pillow and drive to the vet. And it worked out really well. But I just thought it was a really interesting dichotomy of somebody that did such horrible things, you know, stealing life savings of not just strangers, but friends of his family, mm-hmm. but at the same time was so personable, had such a outstanding war record, was such a hero. And I had an investigator that worked on the case that with me and said, hey, he's a good con man because he's good at what he does, whether, you know, it's stealing money or aggressing himself to others or whatever. So the good doctor's right. Just one last comment. I'm a big fan of David Mamet and some of his movies, which feature con men. And my favorite is House of Games, which I highly recommend.
You mentioned that in the book.
That one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, great movie. But anyway, okay. Thanks, Ann. I'm a big fan from the show.
Thank you, Ray. Take care. Maria Konnikova, interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we make the mistake of thinking that if someone is a psychopath, then they're just a bad human being. That's really not true. And you actually have being psychopathic can make you very good at all sorts of things. And we see psychopaths in all walks of life. A lot of them end up in very legitimate professions. So one of the people that I write about in the book was a neuroscientist. Well, still is a neuroscientist, a very respected one who's done a lot for the field. And he was doing two separate studies, one on Alzheimer's and one on psychopaths. And he found a brain scan in the Alzheimer's studies that looked like the brain of a psychopath. And he said, uh-oh, someone made a mistake. Because, you know, this clearly belongs in the other pile. So let's de-anonymize it and figure out what's going on. Well, it turns out no one had made a mistake. He'd used his family's brains as the normal control brains for the Alzheimer's brains, and he was a psychopath. So he found out that way that this whole time he himself was a psychopath, but he ended up a neuroscientist because his life went in a very different direction. So I think that what you're seeing when someone is also, you know, can be a very valiant soldier, yes, the lack of fear has something to do with it, but we also have psychopaths who end up really terrible human beings who do a lot of good in society. You have a lot of serial killers who were also, you know, made charitable donations and were pillars of their community. They really like others to see them as good people. And that's also something that you see with the con artists. So many of the people I spoke with, the con artists I spoke with, would say, but I'm a really, really good person. I'm not a bad human being. I'm not a con artist. This is just my profession. And they make those excuses. I think they really see themselves as pillars of society in many instances.
Do you, I mean, as far as that dark triad goes, mm-hmm. the psychopathy, or is that how you say it, psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism, do you have to have all three of those qualities, or is it some kind of, you know, percentage?
Yeah, you do not have to have all three. In fact, psychopathy, I think it's a Venn diagram with a pretty small overlap.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of psychopaths who don't end up being con artists, and you have a lot of con artists who are not psychopaths. I think the narcissism and the Machiavellianism are actually much more prevalent, because if you think about, you know, who turns to con artistry and who is good at it, well, narcissism really, I think, inspires a lot of people to turn to it, because in the exact same situation, you know, where one person would cut a corner, so we were talking about Armstrong, so where one person would resort to doping and another person simply wouldn't, even with the same pressures, that person would say, no, like that's unfair. That doesn't go well with my moral compass. I'm not going to do that. So that's the narcissism that really, I think, motivates a lot of people, given the right situation, to turn to con artistry. And the Machiavellianism, I think, is almost, it's not essential, but it's incredibly helpful, because you need to have that soft touch. You need to be good at those soft persuasion skills. People need to trust you, and they need to think that they are doing things of their own volition. If they see that they're being manipulated, you are a really bad con artist, because they're going to get out of the situation. That can't be evident. So I think the Machiavellianism really lends the skills.
Mamie in Columbus, you're on the air with psychologist and author Maria Konnikova. Hi, Mamie.
Oh, hi. I just have a quick question. I have a 25-year-old daughter who has been in a long 3.5-year relationship with a man of the same age. And there have been so many things that have arisen that have been red flags, from not being in a place when arriving when he's supposed to. And I guess the biggest, most significant thing for us is he's asked us about marrying our daughter, but she's never met his parents. And every time that's supposed to happen, you know, there's a heart surgery, there's a prematurely born baby, there's always something. And I'm telling you, there is a long litany of things I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have any advice for parents in this situation so that they don't lose their daughter in the process of trying to reveal what may or may not be there, but mm-hmm. all they want is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't want to lose my daughter.
Oh, that is such a terrible place to be in, because obviously the advice that I would give is run, you know, run for cover to your daughter. Because I've actually, I interviewed a lot of people who were in similar situations, one of whom was living with someone who ended up being a con artist. And until that person is ready to hear it, all that's going to happen if you point it out is antagonism. So your daughter will say things like, oh, you just don't want me to be happy. You know, this is what con artists are so incredibly good at. They get you so emotionally invested that an outside observer, so you, can see what's happening and you can actually analyze it and say, uh-oh, red flags, this is terrible. Your daughter can't see the red flags. She literally doesn't see them because she is so emotionally invested in this relationship. And so it's one of those things where it has to be a fine balance where you pick a moment where she isn't as emotionally attached, a moment where she's mad at him, when something's going on, and you make the logical argument as well as you can with a lot of evidence, have all of the facts all lined up, and don't make it seem like you are trying to push her in one direction or another, just that you're presenting this evidence. And even still, it might not work, unfortunately. That's a really bad situation to be in.
Mamie, good luck with that. Thanks for calling. When I was reading the book, it did make me think of cases of domestic violence, not necessarily violence, but really controlling spouses, controlling boyfriends, controlling girlfriends, I guess. A lot of those qualities occurred to me.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And you see, I mean, you see a lot of times that it really is a fine line between, is this person a con artist or is this just a nasty person? By the way, a lot of them can be psychopaths but not con artists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the element of deception really comes in. A lot of psychopaths, they'll be just as emotionally manipulative, abusive, in ways that don't necessarily involve physical abuse. But they're not con artists because they're actually pretty upfront about their lives. If this is someone who's totally an imposter, then it's a con artist. But it's really, I mean, you know, it's not, there's no good dividing line to say you're dating a con artist or you're just dating a bad human being.
There are certain professions that employ more than the usual number of con artists, right?
So, yes, there have been a lot of studies that have looked at the dark triad, and they find, yep, con artists often have that, but so do lawyers, and so do businessmen, and so do politicians, and so do people in advertising and marketing. And so you start seeing that there are lots of legitimate professions where if you actually look closely, the skills are almost identical to the skills of the con artist. Even when I started looking at what I do as a writer, as a journalist, I actually do a lot of the same things because I have to engage emotion. I have to be a good storyteller. When I'm interviewing someone, I have to try to get them to open up and to tell me things that they wouldn't necessarily have told me otherwise. And so you build up trust. You show yourself to be a trustworthy person. You use a lot of the same persuasive strategies that con artists use on their marks. That's a disconcerting feeling to realize just how closely that line can be drawn.
And, you know, I was thinking a lot about, because my background is in print journalism, you know, I grew up in the, oh, remember the Washington Post reporter who made up the story
yep.
about the Lila's world or
yep.
She was a drug addict at 12 or something or
yep.
a prostitute. I mean, that started out maybe one cheating, you know, a little bit of the plagiarism, a little bit of makeup here, a little bit of makeup there. And then the next thing you know.
Yep, absolutely. And that, I think, happens quite often. So that you're talking, I think, about Janet Cook, right. Who actually was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for this story. It really captured everyone's attention. Obviously, the Pulitzer was then taken away. But I think that, so this is what we were talking about earlier, when in the same situation, some people would act in different ways. I think a lot of people who end up being plagiarists, who end up being fabricators. So, you know, we have mm-hmm. Stephen Glass, we have Jonah Lehrer, we have a number of them, not just Janet Cook.
Right.
They do start small, and they see that they get away with it. And they also, I feel like, often get a rush out of it because they said, I did it, and nobody noticed. I mean, that is a feeling of power. And so they do a little more and a little more, and all of a sudden you're fabricating Bob Dylan quotes or you are creating an entire story of characters with a cast of characters that simply doesn't exist. And you are a full-fledged con artist. You don't stop. And that is, I think, what really separates them from a lot of other journalists who would never do something like that. But they wouldn't have cut the first corner either. I think it's the same thing that makes mm-hmm. you cut the first corner that then makes you kind of enamored. It's almost, I think it's a form of addiction, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. It triggers something in the brain. And obviously, we do know that brains, you know, the scans of brains show up differently for people who are psychopaths. So it's all visible. Now, my guest is author, psychologist Maria Konnikova. Her newest book is entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about con artists today, where they come from and why we always fall for it. The con is universal. Recent headlines have highlighted a gigantic con in China.
Chinese police uncover a major online scam. 21 executives from eZubao, which is China's largest peer-to-peer money lending platform, have been arrested over a $7.6 billion Ponzi scheme. That's according to official state news agency Xinhua. Police say senior management stole from nearly a million investors across the country through fake projects on the online financing platform.
Still with us is psychologist and author Maria Konnikova. Her new book is entitled The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. When I heard that headline this morning, Maria Konnikova, I you know, obviously was thinking about your book and thinking about talking to you today. And I wondered, you know, they arrested 21 people, but isn't there usually something like a ringleader? And this isn't sort of like what you were talking about with Lance Armstrong, where he convinced his teammates that it was okay to do what they were doing.
Absolutely. I think oftentimes you find that it's really the culture from the top. And you see this a lot of times in finance fraud and obviously in other types of frauds, where it really is a huge team. So con artists, sometimes they work alone, especially if they're doing imposter cons like Damara, but oftentimes they work with a big team where there's lots of people involved and they are able to that way kind of create all of the drama. And when you're talking about something like what's going on in China, I wouldn't be surprised if they did not catch the ringleader, because that loyalty actually runs very strong. And when you have someone who's orchestrated all of this, that someone is usually incredibly smart and will have protected himself. I say himself because I'm guessing it's going to be a himself when we find out who it is, against a lot of allegations. And a lot of these people aren't even going to allege. But the other point here, and one that I think we've hinted at, is you have to create the culture that allows for this sort of mm-hmm. thing to be accepted. And that sort of thing can only come from the top. So as you say, Lance Armstrong, he was the team leader. If he wasn't the team leader, I don't think people would have felt quite the same loyalty or the same amount of kind of incentive that this is okay, this is how we act. You see this a lot of times in the finance industry, where some companies are known for insider trading and others are not. And a lot of time that's the tone that's set from the top. You know, are we a company that tolerates this, that encourages this, that has a don't ask, don't tell policy as long as you're making good numbers? Or is this a place that's really transparent where that's just not going to be okay?
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, the impetus, the specific impetus was a movie that one of our callers actually mentioned, which was David Mamet's House of Games. And I remember watching it, and the protagonist is this woman who's a psychologist. She's just written a best-selling book. She actually sees patients, so unlike me, she's a clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. And she really knows the ins and outs of human nature. And she becomes involved with these grifters, these con artists, and she knows they're con artists. She thinks that she is learning about them, that she is in on the scam that they're perpetrating, when really the entire time she's the target. And so she ends up falling for this really elaborate con, and the end of the movie is just terrible. Just everything is gone, emotionally, financially, professionally devastated. And at the end of it, I thought, huh, you know, not only is she kind of like me in a lot of ways, but she is really not your typical victim, and certainly not the typical victim that's portrayed in popular media, because you can tell that she's not gullible, she's not stupid, you know, she's not greedy. She doesn't have any of these things that people bandy about as being the hallmarks of victims, and yet she was susceptible to this. So I thought, you know, how does that happen? How prevalent is that actually, and what's going on? And so I tried to find the answer and realized that nobody had ever explored those questions in the past, which was mind-boggling to me. I thought that the book that I wrote would have existed for many, many years, but that's what really prompted me to then spend the next 3 years of my life doing this, because I thought, you know, it's a really, those are important questions to answer.
I heard of Ponzi schemes back in college when someone I worked with reported on it for the state news, and I went to actually one of those meetings where everyone got together back in the 80s, and I don't know what they were doing. But, you know, but still we're shocked by the likes of Bernie Madoff.
Yes, absolutely. And we shouldn't have been, by the way, because Bernie Madoff had a huge Ponzi scheme, yes, but he was far from the first. I mean, the person that I write about in the book, who ran something called the Franklin Syndicate, William Franklin Miller, he operated before there was a word, Ponzi scheme. So he was even before Charles Ponzi, and he had police officers who were kind of investing with him. He had lawyers. He had people who knew better, who were his clients. And even after he was caught, people still kept giving him money because that's how much they trusted that he was actually legitimate. So if we look at what happens with people like him, with people like Madoff, I think that if you're an outside observer, once again, here we once again get at that crucial dichotomy between mm-hmm. being on the outside and being on the inside. As an outside observer, you say those returns are crazy. How is that possible? How is this not a red flag? If you are the person in it, you don't think those are crazy returns. You think that those are very wonderful returns, given you know how well you've invested and how savvy you are. You invested with the right person. You invested with the right fund. See how well you did your homework and your due diligence. See how wonderful this is all shaping up to be, because you are good. You know who to trust. You are a good judge of character. Those returns, those are exactly what you were expecting, given how good this person is.
Yeah, yeah. And otherwise, you're lucky. You mentioned the case of one young woman who was broke. She had $40 to her name. She was doing a kind of a fun trip to New York City, but mm-hmm. she only had $40 for 2 or 3 days, and she blew it on a card shark.
Yeah, on a game of three-card Monte. And it seems just so crazy. And this young woman was really, really smart. She ended up getting a PhD in sociology, was an editor for Scientific American, you know, really intelligent person. And she just got swept up in the narrative drama. And she actually thought that she could win, which I think is exactly what ends up happening with people when they're confronted by this. The con artist is so good, and as we've already talked about, doesn't work alone. So in a game like Three Card Monte, there's mm-hmm. always a shill, someone who walks away really having doubled his money. There's always someone who kind of seems like he has an inside edge. And what ends up happening, even with people who know what Three Card Monte is, so this woman did not, but even people who know Three Card Monte sometimes will end up losing money to Three Card Monte operators, because the operator is so good that he will convince you that you can beat him. So there'll be someone who whispers, hey, you know, follow the card that's slightly bent or that has that slight mark. That's the queen. And so you actually start thinking that you can beat the con artist at his own game, and you obviously can't. But the fact that people who know this will still give money just goes to show they are so good at getting you emotionally invested. They are so good at creating that drama that you really stop thinking rationally. You stop being an objective observer, and you do start thinking you're lucky. This is your lucky day.
And it doesn't matter whether you have $40 or $40 million.
No, it does not. It's the exact same thing. And in fact, we see that people who are victims of investment fraud, which is what Bernie Madoff's fraud was, they tend to be much better educated, much more intelligent, people with often with investment experience of their own. So the ideal victim there is someone who's actually should be someone who knows better but doesn't, because I think there's that sense of overconfidence that you think that you know what you're doing, and so you're not going to see the same signs as someone who really has no clue.
We have an email from Carl who asks if you're familiar with Art Schliester. He was a really famous OSU football player. And of course, OSU football's big here, and he became a horrible gambling addict and a con man to get money for gambling. And he got out of jail, out of federal prison after a long time, came back. I interviewed him. He wrote a book. I interviewed him. I get the charm part of it, and went off and swindled more people right here in Columbus, where everybody knew better than anybody else in the world what a con man he was. And he did it anyway.
You know, that is so quintessentially American, I have to say. And a lot of these cons that really do, I think, have an American flavor, because we always want to believe the story of redemption. Mm-hmm. We always want to think that someone is going to become better than they were in the past. This is why Crichton kept falling for Ferdinand de Mara, because he kept thinking that he was going to be redeemed, that he's this good guy. So he kept giving him more and more chances. And of course, de Mara never went straight. And I think it's just really hard for us to believe that someone can't get better. We really want to think that they can redeem themselves, that they can have this moment of clarity where they'll become good citizens. And in truth, that hardly ever happens. That's just so exceptionally rare, because this is what you and I were talking about with the addiction. I think that sense of power, once you have it, it's so hard to let it go, even if you have legitimate business opportunities, because you miss the rush. You miss the sense of control over other people.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Great program. I'm looking forward to reading the book. And my question is, you've briefly mentioned politicians, and I'm hearing a lot of traits that you're talking about when I look at some of the politicians. One in particular this time, I think you'll know who I'm talking about. So is there a difference between what, you know, a politician would do versus a true con man?
That's a really good question, and it's a question that I wrestle with because I think that we have to be very careful to realize what unites con artists with others, but not to make the name so incredibly inclusive that all of a sudden everyone is a con artist. Mm-hmm. So I think we do have to draw the line somewhere. And where I draw it is at the question of intentionality. So was your intent nefarious? Were you doing this with deception, with kind of your own personal gain in mind, or are you doing this kind of as part of your job? Do you believe in it? Sure, you sometimes stretch the truth, but this is really, you're doing it for what you think are good reasons. And so I think a lot of politicians would fit under that category. Yes, they have to use some of the same tactics because they need to influence people. And basically anyone who's in any sort of a profession like that has to use a lot of those same tactics. But are they con artists? I don't think most of them are. I think most of them really are, on some level, you know, well-meaning, that they want to make the world a better place. They think that they will make the world a better place. That said, there are, of course, some politicians who are con artists where the two go hand in hand. But I don't think it's something that's inherent to everyone who chooses that profession.
Thanks for clearing that up in that question, Dan. Because a lot of people, that's what our minds are on. Now, you also go into quite a lot of detail regarding evangelical, like televangelists, mm-hmm. and that kind of a thing. That's a different breed, too.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways that's just the worst, because they use what all con artists use, which is kind of our need for meaning, for belief, for things that make sense of the world. But they play with kind of the most important beliefs that we have about, you know, our spirituality. Those are incredibly, incredibly powerful things that they mess with. And I'm not saying that all religious leaders are con artists, so one mm-hmm. could certainly make that argument. But there are a lot of them who they end up using things for personal gain all the time. So a lot of the evangelists that I write about, you know, they had either gambling habits or very expensive shopping habits or both, and they basically took money that was not meant for what they used it for. So they did deceive. So that's kind of that line that we're talking about, where you're getting, you're very good at arousing people, and yet you're using it for nefarious ends. That's the question of intentionality. A lot of cult leaders, that's also, that's inherently deceptive, because people don't think they're joining a cult. They think they're joining this wonderful organization that's going to make the world a better place, and then lo and behold, you can't get out, and it's a totally different thing from what you expected it to be. So we see, I think we see that dividing line, and unfortunately, you see a lot of con in religion just because, you know, you already have people who want to believe.
Right. Maria Konnikova, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed being on the show.
Maria Konnikova, she's a psychologist and author of the book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.